welcome to the Theology Podcast. It's great to have you here for this particular live performance or podcast or whatever we want to call it. We are in Huntsville, Alabama at the Stovehouse. So anyway, Glenn just happened to be in Tennessee, I just happened to be in Tennessee, and Tom just happened to have his mouth operated on today. So we're here. Tom is recovering from oral surgery, but we have Larson Hicks standing in for Tom, a very able stand-in, I might add. Anyway,
we'll great. See about that.
That's right. Well, let me introduce myself in case this is the first time you've ever seen this show. I'm C.R. Wiley. I'm a pastor. I serve a church in the Pacific Northwest. I've written some things, and I'm a senior editor for Touchstone Magazine. All right, Glenn.
I'm Glenn Sunshine. I'm a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, ministry associate at Reflections Ministries, a retired and recovering history professor, and I run a ministry called Every Square Inch Ministries.
Well, all right. Well, we need that historian today because of the subject, but let's not get to that yet. Larson, introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Larson Hicks, the CEO of Sycamore Independent Physicians, a physician staffing company, and an elder at Trinity Reformed Church here locally, and we'll stop there.
Yeah, we're very pleased to be associated with Trinity. Trinity has become kind of the home for the Theology Podcast and handles a lot of the administrative stuff and
the
financial stuff and all that kind of stuff, and we appreciate it very much. Anyway, it's my day. So it's my day, and for veterans of the show, you know that we take turns when we don't have guests. Now, Larson's a guest, but he's not really a guest. So anyway. But what I want to talk about today is...
You want to explain the pug?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, right. You might wonder, what in the world is this stuffed animal or stuffed beast or stuffed mythological creature doing on the table in front of me? And Glenn is going to explain.
Well, some years ago, after having probably more beers than I should have, I suggested that we adopt as a mascot a three-headed pug with our faces on it. And this actually turned into a T-shirt, which is arguably the ugliest thing I have ever seen. But since then, the idea of a three-headed dog has been, you know, well, we are... the podcast, after all, and so I ran into this in a shopping mall, or to be more precise, my lovely wife found this in a shopping mall, and I'm going to throw her under the bus, too. And I saw it, and I decided we absolutely had to have it.
Right.
So it's lovely.
Right. Yeah, you were in the gift shop, and you said, what in the world? We have some fans of the Theology Podcast here.
That's right.
They made a three-headed dog. Now, how many heads are on Cerberus?
Three.
Three. All right. So in case you're familiar with Cerberus, and what's the name Cerberus mean, Tom? I mean, Glenn.
Spot.
Spot. So we have Spot here.
That's literally true. Cerberus comes from roots that mean spot.
So Spot the dog with three heads, or three dogs with one body. Anyway, well, antiquity. When we think about the Roman Empire, many things come to mind. And one of the things that may come to mind is in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, the ascetics, the Desert Fathers. Now, what got me thinking about the Desert Fathers is I'm working on a book about resisting the new totalitarianism. And as I've been working on this project, one of the things that struck me as I've been thinking about it is the things that we're up against are not entirely new. They're just more or less contemporary manifestations of things that people have addressed in the past or had to deal with in the past. And one of those is PSYOPs. Now, PSYOPs, psychological warfare. Psychological warfare is as old as the Garden of Eden. PSYOPs is what the devil employed on Eve, right? And so deception is the primary means by which evil pursues its goals. And as I thought about that, and then I thought about the fact that even though it's great to have a church community and it's great to have friends who can be with you in time of need, every once in a while, you're just facing evil and in a human sense, you're entirely on your own. And I thought, who could I look to in, you know, the past for some insight into how to sort of respond to something like this? You know, just being in an environment in which you're subject to deception, visions, and so forth, just on an ongoing basis, and you're all alone. Furthermore, as I thought about it, I couldn't help but remember that there are certain things about Anthony. This is who I'm talking about. Anthony of the desert, Anthony the hermit, Saint Anthony, depending upon the theological tradition you're thinking about him from, was a remarkable person, and we know about him because of a biography that was written by Athanasius. Athanasius was a bishop, and he is the person that we owe a great debt to because of the war that he waged against the Arians. He wrote a book entitled On the Incarnation. And it was the work of Athanasius that helped to precipitate the Council of Nicaea. So pretty significant event. And Athanasius knew Anthony personally. They were friends. So he wrote the life of Anthony as a tribute to his friend. And it became kind of a runaway bestseller in the ancient world. It's hard to believe, but it was. Everybody knew about Anthony. Anthony, you know, the emperor wrote Anthony letters asking for prayer and advice. And what makes this so remarkable is that was the last thing Anthony was after. Now, we live in a world today where church leaders tell us we need to be what? Winsome, right? Yeah. Winsome, friendly. We need to get as close to the world as possible so that they can hear what we have to say. I mean, we need to be so close that there's nothing but a membrane separating us from the world. Anthony took the exact opposite approach. Anthony said, you guys are completely lost. I'm out of here. I'm going into the desert. And the story begins when he's 19 years old. He is an Egyptian aristocrat. It's another interesting thing to note about Anthony. He wasn't like a child of poverty. He was a child of privilege. And at the age of 19, he inherited his estate. And he was made responsible for his sister. His parents died, and he was left with this vast estate. And he sold it all, put his sister into the care of nuns, and went into the desert. And after a period of time, the word got out about him, and people were making pilgrimages to go and visit him to ask for prayer. And he said, I'm getting sick and tired of this. Basically, his response was, go away! Go away, leave me alone! I'm trying to fast and pray! And they just kept coming.
To put this in perspective, he moved into an old Roman fort.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't let anybody in. And people had to throw food over the walls so that he could eat.
So he was pretty extreme. And then he decided, I'm too close to everybody. And he went 3 days out into the desert. 3 days out, and finally found a mountain that had a spring that was at the base of it and some date palms. And he said, I have found it. And then they found him. And pilgrimages went to, you know, to that mountain. And for years, he lived to be 105. This is a guy that ate one meal a day and many weeks would only eat like 2 days a week. I mean, he just was fasting and praying all the time. And I guess it has something to say about, you know, I've actually read about how people in Silicon Valley, you know, guys who are into transhumanism don't eat much, you know, because they've discovered that if you eat less, you live longer. It's a weird kind of thing. Yeah. It has to do with human resilience and physical properties. Anyway, I don't know much about it. I've just seen really emaciated scientists on television talking about not eating and living longer. But anyway, that's right. Now I want you to know that I drink to that. I'm not an ascetic myself. So it's not as though this is something that I'm necessarily commending to you, but it's fascinating to me. It's just fascinating. This guy did everything wrong and changed the world. Mm. Everything, I mean, if you took like your typical church growth, you know, book on how to change the world and just did exactly the opposite, that would be Anthony. And he had huge influence on the world. So it got me thinking a little bit about him. But anyway, Glenn has already kicked in a tidbit I didn't actually come across. Just so you know, I'm not like an authority on Anthony. It's not like I'm Mr., you know, authority on Anthony. I'm just interested in the guy. And I read Athanasius's book, which you can see is not a terribly long book. It's only 106 pages in this edition. And that includes the introduction and a selection from Confessions by Augustine, in which Augustine recounts his first encounter with somebody who told him about Anthony. So fascinating stuff. So anyway, I just hand it over to you guys to sort of gut level reactions about anything I've said to this point or anything you want to throw in.
Awesome.
Well, one of the things that I've always found amusing about Anthony is he goes out into the desert wanting to be a hermit, and pretty soon he gets all these people coming out wanting to be hermits with him.
Sure.
And this kind of left him in a situation where he had to figure out what to do with all of these people. Initially, he turned them away, but they ended up, he's in this old Roman fort on this mountain, and they end up moving into caves all around him, wanting to be near him. They eventually come to him to ask him to be sort of a spiritual mentor to them, and he decides he needs to do that. The problem is he wanted to be a hermit. So how do you organize a community of hermits?
It's an oxymoron.
And
everybody's yelling, "Leave me alone!"
And he actually came up with a system that more or less worked. And this system ends up being, well, it changes a lot over time, but it ends up being the root of monasticism. Hmm. And as Protestants, we tend not to take a very high view of monasticism, but it's important to realize that every major reform movement in church history, whether we're dealing with the Latin Church, the Greek Church, or the Church of the East, always started in monasteries, without exception, up to and including the Protestant Reformation.
Well, there was a guy named Luther.
Who was a monk.
That's right. Right.
So, and the reason for that, by the way, is that values are formed in community, and the monasteries are communities that are set apart from the world, so they inculcate a different set of values than the culture does. The church always gets corrupt when it adopts the values of the culture, note winsome people. And as a result, you know, that is always why the church goes corrupt.
Yeah.
And as a result, you need people in alternative communities who are inculcated in a different set of values to step in and reform the church. And all of that starts with this hermit in the desert.
Put it also into a frame of reference. You know, antiquity, the classical world, particularly during the Halcyon days of the empire, and this is still kind of the good times. They're starting to go bad, but he was born in 251, died in 356 at 105 years of age. But the world that Anthony was born into was a super sensualized world. They didn't have the internet, and they didn't have just the kind of incessant bombarding of the senses that we have, you know, in the privacy of our home necessarily. But they did have a super sensualized, almost pornographic world that they lived in. If you look at the ruins of Pompeii, for example, I mean, the place was just like Vegas without any filters. It was Alexandria as well, which was a very significant center intellectually and economically in the southern, obviously in Egypt. And he was born just outside of Alexandria. And so within that framework, you've got this super sensualized culture, and it's within that framework that asceticism emerges. And I've wondered, and we did a show here in in Huntsville, I think, a little while back on the subject of the new asceticism. I wonder if we might see a revival of asceticism in our world, just because we're facing the same kind of thing.
We already see it. I mean, Aaron Wren talks about that in his article, you know, about avoiding vice, that there's all these movements online that are led by non-Christians that are abstinence from pornography and abstinence from alcohol and other things. They're driven by, you know, non-Christian men who are recognizing how weakening those vices are.
Yeah. I think one of the things too, I think because we're Protestants and because we often view asceticism through the lens of Martin Luther's experience or the corruptions of the late medieval world, we lose sight of maybe other things that were going on. So when you read the life of Anthony, there's not a whiff of earning your salvation.
Right.
It's not there at all. What is he pursuing? He's not trying to earn his salvation. He's working out his salvation. And he's quoting scripture all over the place.
Right.
He's justifying what he's doing based on scripture. And what you see in his reflections is that he's got a very keen sense of the hook that sin has in us. So when we think about, you know, the enemies of our soul, the sin, you know, we talk about, you know, the world, the flesh, and the devil. The flesh is where the hook is.
Yeah.
And the devil and the world grab the hook and pull. And you are enslaved because of the hook.
Right.
So asceticism is directed at the hook. So to give you a biblical basis for thinking about this, let's take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 27. Apostle Paul said, "But I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified." And earlier, he says he beats his body. In other words, he subjects it to the kind of discipline that will enable him to have a little more of an advantage when it comes to facing temptation. That's his main concern. He doesn't ever say this is a way for him to acquire merit.
Right.
He's thinking, I want to be free from the world. And when he says world, he's talking about it in the sense that, you know, we see in the New Testament. You know, when we think about the New Testament, we hear references to the world, but there are two ways in which the world is presented. One is the world for which Christ died, you know, and then there is the world that we're not supposed to love. Mm-hmm. So God so loved the world, that's the world that God made. We're not to love the world, that's the world that we've made. That's what we've made of what God made. And that's what he's trying to free himself from. And another thing to think about is, I think, you know, I mentioned why maybe our Reformed instincts cause us to maybe miss something in Anthony. But the other thing I think we tend to do is we tend to read the wilderness. When we hear references to the wilderness in Scripture, we read it through sort of a romantics lens, you know, Wordsworth, you know, romantic poetry, that kind of thing from the early 19th century, the movement we call Romanticism, where the idea is you go out into the wilderness to get closer to God.
Right.
That's not what they considered to be the case. You went into the wilderness to fight the devil, because it was in the wilderness that you met the wild beast and the demons. So Anthony wasn't trying to escape. He was going out to fight. And his whole story is just a series of episodes of his labors and his battles with the forces of darkness. And he goes into a series of very insightful accounts of his wrestlings with demonic forces. And that was another thing that was I was interested in. I was interested in seeing what was it about this guy that I could learn from that would help me to engage in that kind of warfare today.
Yeah.
So that was what I was looking for.
Well, I think the fact that he was a man on a mission, you know, I mean, like, you know, just coming back to the winsomeness comment, that here's a man on a mission, and lo and behold, people show up to follow him and see what's going on there. He's not, as you said, he's not necessarily escaping to have some private quiet time in the desert. He's going to battle, and lo and behold, that inspires people to come see what he's up to and find out what they can learn from him. So I think that's one of the big, you know, fallacies of the whole winsomeness idea is that we're going to inspire people to follow by sitting there and pleading like the nice guy at the dance who can't get the girl's attention, right? When the bad guy is out there, you know, on the football field or whatever, is getting all the girls.
Right.
So anyway,
right.
That was one sort of observation, at least.
Well, you have anything you wanted to say, Glenn?
At one point, Athanasius comments that the demons were afraid of Anthony.
Hmm. That's right.
That is a really stark comment. And how do you get to that particular point? How do you get to the point where the demons are afraid of you? It comes from the fact that he was utterly unafraid and went in and engaged in a kind of spiritual warfare that is not something that we're familiar with at all in the modern world.
Right. Well, it's like politicians are terrified of other of people that enter the political realm that they don't have any dirt on, you know. And so Anthony was willing to gouge out his eye if it offended him, or cut off his hand if it, you know, he was willing to flee from the temptation of the flesh. And so these demons knew, I've got nothing on this guy, you know, I've got no handles.
Yeah, there's actually the seventh chapter is entitled "The Devil's Powerlessness," where he's mocking the devil. And there's this marvelous episode, though, earlier on, where he recounts a vision he has. Now, when we think about the visions, you know, I'm willing to entertain a range of possibilities. These are dreams. These are things that actually, you know, are manifesting themselves physically to him. I don't really care. What he says, though, in relationship to these things, I think is the more interesting thing. And that is that the only thing, well, he makes this point. This is a very post-mill kind of argument. He says, Christ defeated them on the cross and through his resurrection. They have nothing. Mm-hmm. They have nothing, which means all they can do is lie. So the art is discerning the lie. Mm. That's the art. So he recounts this in the third chapter, his life in the tombs. He went into live among in a graveyard for a while, just for fun. So he says, thereupon in the night, they made such a crashing that it seemed the whole place was shaken by an earthquake. And as they had broken through the four walls of the building, the demons seemed to rush in through them in the guise of beasts and creeping things. And the place was at once filled with the forms of lions, bears, leopards, bulls, serpents, asps, scorpions, and wolves. And each moved according to its own likeness. The lion roared, ready to spring. The bull seemed thrusting with its horns. The serpent crept, yet reached him not. The wolf held itself as if ready to strike. And the noise of all the vision was terrible, and their fury cruel. Anthony, beaten and goaded by them, felt keener bodily pain. Nevertheless, he lay fearless and moved and more alert in spirit. He groaned with the soreness of his body, but in mind he was cool and said jestingly, if you had any power in you, it would have been enough that just one of you should come. But the Lord has taken your strength away, and that is why you try to frighten me. if possible, by your numbers. It is a sign of your helplessness that you have taken the shapes of brutes. That's pretty base. You
know? That's pretty cool.
You know, it's like, hey, you got nothing. It's, I mean, if you had anything, you wouldn't resort to this mental game.
Yeah.
And as I thought about that, I thought, this is really what we're up against. We live today in a world of illusions. What is AI? What is the internet? What is all this stuff? It's illusory. It's all illusions. And its ability to move us, the ability of these things to move us have to do with the hook. There's already a hook in us. And if the hook can just be grabbed, then we can be manipulated, turned, twisted this way and that. And that got me thinking, the real battle, kind of the first battle, is to master the hook. If you can master the hook, then there's nothing that can be done to you. Because they've got nothing. That's his whole point. And that's just like one of several episodes that Anthony recounts of his encounters with these forces.
Yeah, I think the comment about you know, the asceticism being more about the hook and more about sin and dealing with sin and not about merit and earning salvation, that seems to be a pretty drastic pivot, you know, for folks who read history through Reformed Protestant lenses. We kind of always want to reduce things to, you know, the gospel as defined by, you know, soteriology very narrowly.
Yeah, and I think it's true. You know, we were, our ancestors in the Reformed faith were responding to the corruptions of the late medieval Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Anthony was in the 4th century, the 3rd and 4th centuries, and there was no pope.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no established, you know, now there were bishops, but there was a very sort of, you know, you think about this, here's one way to think about it. I know this is a weird way to put it, but in the history of American automobiles, do you ever go back to like the early 20th century and see how many automakers there were? It's like they were on every corner. Hmm. There were dozens and dozens of different companies, and they ended up getting bought up, just kind of like the way, you know, Waze was just bought by Google not too long ago. You know, so eventually they all get, there's a consolidating process, and then you end up with these big, you know, sort of umbrella sort of holding companies.
Sure.
But all of the, you know, the General Motors companies were once independent, you know, Buick and, you know, Pontiac and Chevy. They were all independent. They were their own companies at one time. They get bought up. Now, so what we're looking at when we get to the 15th century is General Motors.
Yeah.
But what life was like, you know, in the Christian world at that time was more like 1920. It was just a much more sort of open situation. And this is also during the period when the Arians are ascendant. And they're, you know, there's a sense in which people don't know which way it's going to go. Today we look back on it and say, oh, obviously, Nicene Creed, we've got that all worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That wasn't the case. It was... And Anthony's statements about the Arians at this time are pretty raw. They weren't winsome statements, you know. He wasn't trying to be nice to those guys. He basically said, you guys are servants of the devil.
Right.
Anyway, much more sort of open, sort of raw, feisty world in the church.
You know, one of the things that, you know, going back to the spiritual warfare side, a lot of the evangelical world, including some of the circles I travel in, completely, you know, ignores, downplays it. You bring it up and you're met with this awkward silence, those kinds of things. One of the things I think that has helped quite a bit in at least some circles is Heiser's books, And along with that, frankly, Haunted Cosmos. For those of you who aren't familiar, it's a podcast that deals with a lot of weird stuff. And while I wouldn't exactly affirm everything Haunted Cosmos does, at least they're trying to wake people up to the fact that we are dealing with a world that's a lot bigger than we normally think it is.
Yeah.
The invisible world, if I'm understanding scripture correctly and if I'm extrapolating correctly, is every bit as complicated as the physical world we see. It is occupied by a wide range of denizens and even has its own, well, non-living components. Mm-hmm. You know, the throne room of heaven is not alive. And these are things that are fundamental to biblical understandings of the world and the way it works. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow in our emphasis on sola scriptura, we sort of miss that.
Yeah, we miss all the references to the devils and
right.
the stuff.
Yeah, yeah. and the fact that there is this invisible world out there.
Right.
And which demonstrates to me that we're more children of the Enlightenment than we are of scripture.
Yeah, yeah. Now, thinking about, well, we were just having a conversation over dinner, Larson, about masculinity.
Yeah.
And how, you know, I mentioned that I've connected with an MMA fighter here recently who is an Olympic Greco-Roman wrestling right. champion and that kind of thing, a silver medalist. And, you know, we're like, this is really cool. But sometimes these same guys don't have any sense of the fight when it comes to spiritual matters.
Right.
They kind of are wimps when it comes to that. This is one of the things that's interesting. I think that when we think about courage, we tend to think of it as something that is distributed evenly across every realm. But I've known guys who are physically courageous, but really wimps in every other part of their lives.
Right.
And I've known guys who are maybe courageous in maybe business, but wimpy in, you know, physical matters. So, but I think the thing to think about with Anthony, there's a term that people have used, and that is athletes of God. So Anthony was referred to by many people as an athlete of God, engaged in wrestling with demonic forces. And if you look at the art that depicts the life of Anthony, often he is portrayed actually in physical combat with demonic forces.
Yeah.
You know, you'll see him kind of suspended in the air being attacked simultaneously by three or four demons.
Right.
You know, I've kind of been inspired. I might like to get one of those paintings.
That's awesome.
Just to kind of remember this guy. But that's the way he saw himself too. He saw himself as going out into the desert to fight, not going out into the desert to get away. Hmm. And are we up for that kind of fight?
Right.
And the first victory that you have to win is over yourself. Now, this is also true with physical combat, right?
Yeah.
You got to train yourself. You've got to discipline yourself. You've got to overcome the pain and the hardship and the struggle that training and physical preparation require.
Right.
Right? It's the same kind of thing spiritually.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the glory of a young man is his strength. And I tend to think that that's preparation for what you're talking about. What Anthony was doing was the more glorious, you know, form of courage and strength, which is found in spiritual battle and in competence and in fighting powers and principalities, whether it's out in the marketplace or wherever, right? And so it's very masculine to be physically, to have physical prowess. But that's all of benefit, as Paul says. It's of benefit. It's of some benefit. But the real deal is the spiritual.
Yeah, and when Anthony would come to town, people knew.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like Anthony came to town and people didn't know who he was. His reputation grew so enormous that, as I noted earlier, the emperor sent him a note. And it's funny. He's when he receives the letter, They're actually witnesses when he receives a letter. He's kind of like rolling his eyes, you could almost say. It's like, all right, I got to respond to this letter. And then he says to his disciples, don't be impressed when a king addresses you. He's just a man. Instead, be impressed that we have the law of God. You know, and he goes on to extol the significance of God's law with his companions. You know, that's the kind of guy he was, and he was the real deal. And he was very humble also. That's the other thing about it. He had this, so there's, did I mention the encounter with the philosophers yet?
No, this is
marvelous. So there are these Greek philosophers that show up, and he knows who they are just because of the way they're dressed. Apparently there was like a way a philosopher's dressed.
Hipsters.
A uniform.
Sure. He looks out and he says, there's a bunch of Greek philosophers over there.
Patches on their elbows. Yeah.
They've come out into the desert to visit him. And he gets an interpreter and he goes out and the first thing he says to them is, why have you come all this distance to talk to a fool? So he calls him out at that moment. That was a very savvy move. It was a very savvy move. And they say, oh, no, you're not a fool. You're very wise. And then Anthony says, if I'm so wise, why don't you become like me? I'm a Christian. If I had gone 1,000 miles to visit you, I'd try to be like you. And then by the time they're done, they're Christians. There's no winsomeness in this at all. He's not like complimenting them or anything like that. You know, he's just giving it to them straight.
Yeah.
And saying, you guys need Christ.
Yeah, it's the winsomeness of competence, you know, of being formidable, of having gravitas, you know, versus, you know, begging and trying to appeal and trying to imitate in a really weak, sappy, lame way.
Trying to get into the New York Times.
Yeah.
The Atlantic Monthly, you know, kissing people's whatever. Anyway.
Now, there is another thing here that we do need to say, though, and that's that while Anthony didn't go out into the desert to escape, he went out to fight. He, in going to the desert, he did escape from certain things. What going to the desert represented, in a big way, was his rejection of the culture. Mm. It's the rejection of all of the things that this world had to offer him. Mm. Remember, he was a landowner, actually a very prosperous landowner. He could have had pretty much anything that was available to the world at that time. He could probably have gotten.
But his early temptations are temptations surrounding money and sex.
Right. So leaving part of his wrestling, you know, going into the desert to fight, part of that actually involved a conscious turning away from and a rejection of the values and the things that the world considered important. And that's something we also have to remember. It's not like Antony could have done the things that he was doing if he had stayed in Alexandria. Mm-hmm. He couldn't have. So it does involve a turning away from the things that the culture foists on you.
Yeah, I'd like to reflect on this a little bit because this is one of the things that intrigued me with his story. So this is a guy who I would say is aristocrat of the spirit. Aristocrat of the spirit. Yet he has this leavening influence on the larger culture. So yes, there are a lot of imitators who say, I want to be just like him, and they go out and they live in caves nearby. But he had an influence on Augustine, who became a bishop. And the story of Anthony had an influence on him. And we think about Augustine, I mean, he was a one percenter. I mean, he was part of the elite, you know, in Milan. He was hobnobbing with all sorts of powerful people. He had the pleasures of this life in abundance. And it's in the midst of this that he encounters the story of Anthony, and it hits him like a slap in the face. Yeah. And it's that slap in the face that I think I'd like to think about. You know, like the old, what was it? The aftershave.
old,
You get slapped a couple of times to say thank you. I needed that. That was the kind of the byline in the ad, and that's what Aquavelva. It was Aquavelva.
Okay.
Anyway, you can look it up on YouTube. But anyway, that's what I think. So it wasn't as though his asceticism left the rest of the world kind of to itself. It actually influenced it in some important ways. Like I think that one of the reasons why our Western culture had such a strong sense of the right and the wrong when it comes to sexual ethics for centuries is because of the sort of the rejection of the sexual promiscuity and sensuality of the classical world that you see, you know, in some sense personified by Anthony. And that's why I wonder if the thing that we need right now isn't some super clever, you know, entrepreneurial pastor who figures out the next megachurch strategy. I've lived through those. Mm-hmm. I can give you names that you don't even know who were the biggest deal in their time. Robert Schuller. Most people have no clue who Robert Schuller was. He was the biggest deal in the world in the 1980s. Bill Hybels in the 1990s. Everybody wanted to be Bill Hybels. I bet you most of the people listening to me have no clue who those guys were. They were bigger than Tim Keller. Mm. They were a lot bigger than Tim Keller. I think Tim Keller will be forgotten in another 10 years, just like they were forgotten. Mm. Anthony lives. He still has a huge shadow that he casts. And is there something like that? I'm not saying that we're going to have another Anthony or we're going to go out into the desert and stuff like that. But I wonder about maybe this, what this culture needs is not, as I said earlier, somebody who is just trying to put a Jesus gloss on the latest cool thing, mm-hmm. the style of music or whatever it is, but just says, you know what, this is, what we need to do is we need to focus on Christ and pay the price and get the hook out. Mm-hmm. You want to be free? Focus on the hook.
Well, I've heard you guys say on this podcast before that what is uniting, like new battle lines are being drawn in the church today, and it's no longer over soteriology, it's more sociology, it's more that the alliances, you know, the alliances that we would have with Anthony Esselin, you know, who's Catholic, would be a lot closer than the alliance we might have with somebody from the, you know, the PCA or a Protestant denomination. It seems that focus on soteriology leads to this kind of reductionism where the question that believers are always asking today is it okay if I, am I allowed to do this? Is it necessary for me to do this? Must I do this? And it always comes back to, no, you don't have to. It's all about just faith. So no, you don't have to do that thing we deleted our Netflix account. Do I have to do that? Well, no, you don't have to be saved, but is it a good idea? You know, like, yeah, it might be a good idea. So there's this sort of, obsession with soteriology that I think leads to this reductionism and this kind of, it's the complete opposite, I guess, of what Anthony seemed to be interested in, which was how do I get this hook out, you know, by any means necessary, and I'll take drastic measures if I have to.
Yeah, and when you read his story, you know, it's not as though he arrived at the year 100 and was said, I'm there. You know, he, even it on his deathbed, it's a fascinating account of his death. So he's 105 years old, and he's surrounded by these devoted followers, and he's saying, I'm going to die soon. I want you to bury me where no one can find me. Only two people knew where his body was laid. So to this day, we don't know where Anthony is. We know the mountain that he was in, that he was at, but we don't have any clue where he was put, because he made those two guys swear they would never tell. Because he's from Egypt, and what did they do in Egypt? They take you home, dress you up, mummify you, and put you in the living room. He said, I don't want that. I just want to be buried.
Yeah.
like my Lord.
Yeah.
That was his argument. You know, the Lord was buried. He wasn't like mummified and put into a room.
Yeah.
And he believed in the resurrection. Anthony believed in the resurrection of the body. He was a firm believer in that. So, you know, as we think about him, yeah, I think maybe it's good for us to think a little bit about maybe ways that Anthony's example or maybe the environment in which he was in weren't entirely right. So, you know, as we think about those things, sometimes I think that people who pursued the ascetic sort of ideal lost sight of the good things in this life. Anthony was a bit conflicted on this. So, for example, people would come to him and ask for him to pray for their healing, and he'd never turn them away and say, the needs of the body are nothing, why don't you just die?
Yeah.
He would pray for them. And then he would warn them. He said, I don't have any power to heal you. It's Christ who heals you. You know, I want you to make sure you don't get this wrong. It was Christ who heals you. You know, if you're healed, it's Christ. If you're not, it's not God's will. That's it. So he was very clear about that. When he went out to that mountain in Sinai, he was out there, and people started to make these pilgrimages, and he said, I've got to give them something to eat after their long journey. So he planted a garden, not for himself, but so that he could give them bread and vegetables after their long journey. So he was ministering to their physical needs. So he wasn't against the body, but I do think that people took the ascetic ideal in directions that were not good.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to acknowledge that.
I find that people have a hard time holding more than one idea in their head. It's like that's a cool idea. Let me just obsess about that and
Right.
Yeah. You actually find the Irish church, which is something I spend a fair amount of time with, was heavily influenced by the Desert Fathers. In their case, it could get kind of extreme and weird, but it also bore tremendous fruit in a lot of different ways. But then you have other people who are ascetics who are doing things that are kind of out there. Probably my favorite example is a guy by the name of Simeon Stylites.
Yeah, that's right.
who spent decades living on top of a Roman column. He would lower a basket and people would put bread in it and such, and he'd haul it up. And he just lived on top of this column. And when that got to be a little bit too easy for him, he ended up standing on one foot. And he actually developed a reputation for being a very wise man for doing this. You know, people would come to him and yell questions up to him, and he would give them answers. And actually, the answers were pretty good.
Yeah.
But this is a little bit out there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that, you know, we need to make certain that we give that caveat that, you know, to anything taken too far is weird. Now, Anthony, though, was a picture of health. You know, he lived at 105. And a very strict diet, and he was always in a good mood and always had a good sort of disposition. He wasn't a grumpy, surly person at all. He was a very affable and easy person to interact with and spend time with, according to all the accounts.
When he was willing to talk to you.
Yes, right. But and then later in his life, he did kind of get beyond this. You know, later in his life, he got to the point where he said, okay, I'll spend time with you. But I think the thing to keep in mind with that is he really felt like it's not like he was making a sacrifice in one sense, but in another sense he was, because he really cherished his life as a contemplative, you know, his prayer life. And he had a vast reservoir of memorized scripture. That's another thing. Maybe I mentioned it already, but if I haven't, let me say it now. he doesn't quote other church fathers. He doesn't quote theologians. It's entirely scripture. He could call it from memory, you know. So, you know, he's not the object, or he's not the picture that we have of the medieval monk. He's something different. So he's an old man, 105 years old, still walking miles, still, you know, working on his garden, still has all of his teeth in his head. He's, according to the legends, he had 20/20 vision until his death. You know, he's just this freak.
Start the St. Anthony diet plan. That sounds like
right. Now, the things I'd like to reflect a little bit, you know, we've talked about him in different ways. I'd like to reflect a few things that I think he got right. One is the priority of the soul. Now, he didn't disparage the body. He was a defender of the incarnation. So it's not as though he believed in the bodily resurrection, you know. So, but he did believe that the spirit should take precedence, or should be focused on. In other words, the development of spiritual virtues and so forth, the prayer life. You know, you think about, you know, Christ's warning in Matthew 10 and Luke 12 concerning don't fear the ones who can harm the body, but fear the one who can throw the body and the soul into hell. So, you know, he's focused on spiritual things without neglecting ministering to people's physical needs. During the persecutions of Diocletian, he would go into the prisons. Everybody knew who he was, and he'd minister to those who had been persecuted, locked up for their confession of Christ.
And just a quick note there, we all know about Nero. The persecution under Diocletian was far more severe. It was the worst persecution in the Roman Empire.
Mm. Yeah. Then I already mentioned his focus on the hook. He was, the ascetic tradition was focused on not trying to earn your salvation, at least it's the way Anthony practiced it, but on victory over sin. That was the thing. That was the goal. That I want to get the hook out as best I can. Now, I'd like to spend the last part of our episode just thinking about how this applies to our world today. Is there anything that we can take from Anthony that can help us deal with the situation that we're in? And one of the things I mentioned earlier is that we live in a world of illusions. But, you know, we generate the illusions. You know, Hollywood, you know, artificial intelligence, all of these things are creating illusions that are intended to entice us. And they're all flattering, and they all appeal to the sensual part of our lives. And to our egos. So I think that what we can take from Anthony, this is one thought, and I'd like to hear if you have anything to add to it, a philosophy of spiritual freedom, being free to serve God, and free from sin. Not in the sense that we have, you know, through our own efforts, come to a place where we can say we have defeated sin, but more of a working out of your salvation kind of a thing, where he knew that Christ had saved him. If you read this, you read the account, there's no way you could say that he was trying to earn his salvation. Mm-hmm. But he was trying to live his life in the body to the glory of God. That was his objective. And I think that's a similar challenge that we face, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, well, I've thought in my own, you know, journey sort of trying to raise children, you know, that I've had this progression in my own thought as a disciple of Christ that there was this sort of false, I think, false promise of worldview I think worldview's been sold, has been oversold, you know, as this panacea, you know, for all that ails, you know, the church, that if we just get the worldview right, your kids are going to turn out. Except that, you know, we all know kids who grew up in classical Christian schools who went off the rails. And so there's this sort of recalibration of, okay, hold on. I know worldview matters, but is it the thing, you know, that is going to be, that's going to help my children persevere in the faith? And so I think freedom from, I've thought my own estimation of the quality or the benefit of a school for my children has become less about the doctrines or the methodology, you know, the their approach to the pedagogy or whatever, and it's become more focused on how interested are they in training the habits of my children, you know, of disciplining sin, you know, of helping my children, you know, helping my wife and I, assisting us in seeing sin that we're not seeing at home, or having a perspective on their sin that we don't have. And so I think that's one way where there's this, you know, we're trying to free our children from trying to pull the hook out of their mouths. And yes, ideology matters. And yes, theology and philosophy and worldview matter. But if you still have this massive hook in your flesh, sorry, it's not going to turn out well.
Right.
Yeah. Until the 20th century, the purpose of education in the West was universally, actually not only in the West, was pretty much universally viewed as being virtue formation.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of education was to form character and to develop the virtues. In the 20th century, with Dewey and others, and education being really designed to produce good corporate workers, that changed.
Right, right.
And a recovery of this idea of virtue formation in education, I think, is really critical.
Yeah.
That's not exactly Antony. Antony was, it seems, illiterate.
Yep, he was.
He only spoke Coptic, didn't speak Greek, yet I have translators, you know, to communicate with the people around him. But one of the things that is important with Antony, I think, is the idea of spiritual disciplines. You know, as Protestants, we're really good at Bible. We talk a good game about prayer, but we don't really do it. And if you have any questions about that, consider that according to a Barna survey that I read about, I haven't been able to track it down, the average Christian in America prays 2 to 4 minutes a day, and that includes grace at meals.
Right.
That's a concrete demonstration that we don't believe in prayer, because if we did, we'd do it more.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, churches that have prayer meetings, it's only a fraction of the congregation that attends. Why? Because they don't believe in prayer. Mm-hmm. Simple as that. But there are other disciplines that are important as well, besides just scripture and prayer. With Antony, we see fasting, we see solitude, we see silence. All of these things are classic disciplines that have been used for spiritual formation throughout Christian history. You see them active in Jesus's life, and if Jesus needed to do them, we probably do too. And yet somehow these things are never discussed. Or very rarely.
Yeah. When I think about spiritual disciplines, it's, you know, we think about what they are. I think we might lose sight of what they're intended to do. So, you know, like when I think about silence, we spend most of our time trying to justify ourselves to other people or to make ourselves seem like we're more than we are. That's part of the fallen condition that we find ourselves in. When you have to shut up, you can't do those two things. It's kind of like a weaning away that occurs.
But silence works two ways. It's our own silence, and it's also the silence of what's around us.
Yeah.
We are addicted to distraction.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a rabbit trail, but Glenn gave me permission to go on rabbit trails, so... But one of the thoughts I've thought about a lot recently is how God built us with this dopamine sort of response system that you know you accomplish something And then there's this dopamine, this release of dopamine and this sense of satisfaction for accomplishing something. And we now have an internet that is has been engineered to tap into that system, and or video games that tap into that system. And so, you know, Instagram, you sort of have this craving for dopamine, and then you go do something on the internet that, that satisfies it. And so it's another kind of silence. It's sort of, I came across a thing the other day about a guy saying, you know, the way that I've recovered the ability to just focus on my job and get work done is to like put a chair in the other room, in the other side of the room, and go sit in it without my phone and just wait until I'm bored enough to go work. And then I go work. And then, sure. And then slowly I sort of develop this reward system that God's built into me, that I do work and it feels good,
right?
And I want to do more work. But we've sort of, that's been all hijacked.
Yeah, and I think that's a great reminder that what Anthony was after was higher things. It wasn't as though he was against, a sense of accomplishment or a sense of joy in God's presence. He was actually after that stuff.
Yeah.
What he was trying to do is exchange lower things for higher things. That was his thinking, lower things for higher things. A couple of other things I want to just note about Anthony. A big thing that comes through in, you know, Athanasius' biography is the victory that Christ won is huge. So Christus Victor is super important to Anthony. And he believed that this was the key to discerning the lies of the devil. Mm. So he used this as a way for him to see through the illusions. Mm. And I think, he believed that all healing came from Christ. It wasn't him. It wasn't his good works. It wasn't his self-denial. It was all he was trying to do was trying to provide a greater stress in his own mind on what Christ had accomplished, and he wanted to communicate that to other people. Other people too. Another thing is, we have nothing to fear. Mm. So Anthony's life was characterized by a kind of boldness, a courage, a fearlessness. He just didn't think twice about offending people or saying what was right. Now, he was very sharp. He was very clever. This is one of the things that Athanasius is like this, you know, he's one of the great minds in the history of the church.
Yeah.
And Athanasius was impressed with Anthony.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, this guy just had this homespun wisdom. He just could kind of read things and read people and know what to say and know what to do. And he was never trying to impress anybody. But he knew that the devils had nothing. And so the thing he needed to, and this is interesting. There are points in the book where it's said of him, he could read the devils. He knew what their weaknesses were.
Hmm.
So think about that. So he was able to analyze things in that way. And then his winsomeness came from a contempt of the world. That was his winsomeness. His contempt for the pleasures of this world. And it was his purity that made him winsome.
Mm-hmm.
But he never flattered. He didn't flatter the emperor. He didn't flatter the Greek philosophers. He didn't flatter any of them. He just said things. He said things that were true. He just said, this is the way it is. So he believed that he was surrounded by devils because because Satan is the prince of the power of the air. And he has this vision. There's a point where he has this vision of Satan as this monstrous, like a mountain, filling the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And the demons are just around him constantly.
Yeah.
So he believed that he was constantly surrounded by demonic forces, and that they were always trying to deceive him. I can't think of a better analog to our situation today with the internet, with media. We are surrounded by lies and liars. And they flatter us, and they're trying to get us to do things. They've got a hook into us, and they're twisting that hook, trying to make us do what they want. I think the thing to so let me just finish on this note, and I'll let you guys have the last word. But did it ever occur to you why, you know, to ask the question, why didn't Adam and Eve ask the devil in the garden, "What's in this for you?" That's all it would take. You come to me out of nowhere, telling me this stuff because you want me to do something. What's in this for you? If they had just simply thought to ask that question, they would have stripped the lie of its power. And they would have seen that it wasn't about them trying to make them gods. It was about enslaving them. That's what it was about. And that's what everybody in Google and Facebook and whatever, anything, they're out to get something from us. How do they wrap it? They don't wrap it in, "We're trying to enslave you." What they say, like when they're trying to sell you, when they're trying to sell you a loan, do they say, "We want to enslave you for the next 30 years at 5%. You know, no, they say, we want to help you get a house, right? Now, I'm not saying that loans are necessarily bad or anything like that, but let's be real. What's going on? This isn't about freedom. This isn't about self-actualization. This is about people trying to get things from you, the devil trying to get things from you, corporations trying to get things from you. So if you can discern the spirits, you can disarm them.
Well, one of the things that makes me think about is your comments about flattery and about the question that Adam and Eve should have asked Satan, "What's in it for you?" One of the points that drives home to me is the need for. I think in your book, Man of the House, you talked about the professions, you know, and the idea of an honorarium, you know, where they're the you know, clergy and medical and legal professions that had an honorarium that wasn't tied to any profit motive. It was just society basically said, "We want these people to not have a profit incentive because we want them to just speak the truth." And I think about the internet celebrity pastors, you know, who are on the internet telling you what you need to be doing. And I think we need to be asking the same question: what's in this for you, right?
So I've got something to reveal.
Yeah.
Facebook approached me and offered me money to post.
Okay.
I get paid by Facebook every month, just so you know. Full disclosure, I get paid by Facebook. And it was a fascinating process to see how they tried to seduce me to post certain things and not post other things.
Hmm. Yeah.
Certain things go viral.
Yeah.
Other things don't. And I looked at it after a while. I said, there's a little incentive system going on here.
Yeah.
That's going on all the time.
Yeah.
On Instagram, on X, it's going on all the time. So when you see your celebrity pastor guy, it's not about just that.
Well, and it reinforces to me the need for a real life flesh and blood pastor who's sitting across the table from you and who's paid a salary, whether he tells you to knock it off or not. Right. And our need, you know, if you want to be free, one of the ways you can be free is put yourself under the you know, subjection to a pastor. You know, who actually cares about your soul, and what's in it for him is his relationship with God and his calling by God to care for your soul and his desire to please God, and not some profit motive. So anyway, that's one of the ways you could free yourself from, you know, those influences.
Anything, Glenn, you want to leave us with?
I think if you asked Anthony what he was about with his followers, he would have said, with Paul, "Follow me as I follow Christ." Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is really the punchline of the whole thing to me, that it is worthwhile to find those people who are following Christ and follow them.
Right, right.
That's, you know, that kind of spiritual mentorship is invaluable. So.
Great. Well, thank you for listening to the Theology Pugcast. And thank you, audience, for coming out tonight. It's great to be in front of, like, regular people. Usually we're in our houses just kind of talking to each other over the internet. And thank you for listening and getting all the way to the end of this episode. And your reward is to hear us talk about Patreon. Aren't you glad? Anyway, we do have a number of people who support the show. Glenn and Tom and I, we don't take anything from the podcast. Obviously, we find it a great thing to be a part of, but we don't take any monetary return from it. But there are expenses, and the people who support us on Patreon help to take care of those expenses, producing and posting the show each week. And we are also on our way to the United Kingdom. We're going to Oxford here, not too far in the future. We're going to be there in late May. And if you have an interest in helping us out with that effort, we have an Indiegogo campaign. Now, just so you know, our way is paid. We have a very generous donor who's paid for our flights, not just for us, but our wives and others. And we've got a marvelous Airbnb awaiting us that have been set up for us. We're going to be in a house just walking distance from everything we need to be near. And we've even got rental cars and all that kind of stuff. But this generous person didn't think to pay for all of the production costs of the episodes and those kinds of things. So if you'd like to help out with that, and we're doing a documentary for the trip on the Inklings. If you'd like to help out with that, there's a link in the show notes to the Indiegogo campaign. Anyway, that's it for now. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See you.
The Theology Pugcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. To learn more about the church, you can visit trinityreformedkirk.com. TrinityReformedKIRK.com.